Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 11. Phineas P. Quimby. Phineas Parkhurst Quimby was a native of Lebanon, New Hampshire, where he was born on February 16, 1802, to Jonathan Quimby, a blacksmith, and his wife Susanna. When he was 2 years old, his father and mother moved to Belfast, Maine, and when he was 13 or thereabouts, being small of stature and not overly strong, his father decided that the calling of a blacksmith would be too hard for him and apprenticed him to a clockmaker. It was not a hit-or-miss choice on his father's part. From his earliest childhood, the little Phineas was fascinated by anything that worked. And in order to get things to work exactly, his patience was inexhaustible. Clockmaking was almost an obvious choice. It was, moreover, a trade in which a man could quickly make a name for himself if he was an honest and skilled craftsman. People demanded good clocks, and bad clocks quickly revealed their deficiencies. Seth Thomas, the elder of Plymouth Hollow, Connecticut, was already turning out clocks which attained a standard only exceeded by that of his son. And to make a clock as good as one turned out by Seth Thomas was, in all probability, the dizzy height set for himself by young Phineas Quimby when he entered on his apprenticeship in Belfast, Maine. If it was, he reached his objective, for Quimby clocks are still to be found in Maine, and they long enjoyed a reputation for accuracy and good workmanship. However, young Quimby was not only interested in the workings of clocks, but in the workings of anything. He was a natural inventor, and never was so happy as when he had some new contraption with which to amaze his friends. Moreover, boy and young man, he was eager in debate and mercilessly Socratic in argument. Quick to recognize faults or inaccuracies in almost anything where others would pass them by, he had a way in an argument of compelling his opponent to toe the line, which quickly earned him a reputation at the general store or where not as a champion debater. Belfast, Maine, in those days, was a busy little town, devoted to shipbuilding, and lying as it does at the head of Penobscot Bay, it was considered of sufficient importance to be invested by the British towards the close of the War of 1812. Like many other coast towns, moreover, Belfast enjoyed an intercourse with the outside world and the great coastal cities, like Boston, New York, and Baltimore, denied in the days before the railways to the inland towns, and was, as a consequence, sure, sooner or later, of a visitation from any rage or person much in the public eye. And so, one day in the late 30s, there arrived in Belfast a certain Frenchman named Charles Poyen, who advertised a course of lectures in the town hall on the then much-discussed question of mesmerism. Belfast flocked to hear him, and among those eagerly present was Phineas Quimby. Charles Poyen found a sympathetic and attentive audience, and all went excellently well, until he came to giving practical demonstrations of mesmeric influence. Immediately, he found himself in difficulties. things did not work out as they should, and the task which he claimed he usually found so simple was labored and exhausting. At last, he spoke to his audience about it. Someone, consciously or unconsciously, was working against him, was his explanation. He would be glad if the person responsible for it would remain after the meeting and have a talk with him, as he felt sure he must be a mesmerist of considerable promise. Whether Phineas Quimby thought himself the man or not, he was evidently determined to make the claim. Such an opportunity was too good to let pass by, and so, as the audience filed out, he remained, and very soon he and M. Poyen were in close conference. That Poyen succeeded in convincing Quimby of his mesmeric powers is evident, for within a few days, Phineas was giving free exhibitions in the general store, and much to the satisfaction of the proprietor, willing people to come in off the street and buy of his wares. Phineas Quimby took the matter seriously, as he always did. He read everything he could get on the subject, among others, no doubt, Poyen's own book, Progress of Animal Magnetism in New England. He also seems to have followed Poyen for a time from town to town, until at last, quite convinced of his own powers, he began to practice on any of his friends who were willing to become subjects. His success in inducing magnetic sleep was immediate and uniform, and from that he went on to willing away minor ailments. Once satisfied that he could do that, the matter was settled as far as he was concerned. Here was something infinitely more engaging than clockmaking or inventing. If minor ailments could be healed, more serious ones could be healed. He tried and was apparently successful. People began to talk about him and to come to him for help in increasing numbers. So matters went until sometime in 1842, when Quimby made a new discovery. Among the many subjects who had come under his influence was a youth named Lucius Berkmar. He was a boy that, according to the neighbors, had always been queer. But under Quimby's influence, he exhibited the most surprising powers. When thrown into a mesmeric trance, so some said, he could describe people and places he had never seen, tell the location of ships at sea, and report happenings of the moment in distant places, which were subsequently verified. Most amazing of all, he also appeared to have the power of looking into people, and diagnosing disease and prescribing remedies, which in many cases healed them instantly. So goes the story. Quimby was astounded and enthusiastic. He determined to give up clockmaking and go on a lecture tour with Berkmar. This he did for a time with great success. Quimby, however, was an intelligent man. Indeed, he had unquestionable gifts as a scientific research student. He never had been satisfied with just seeing things work. He demanded to know how they worked. At first, he had been satisfied that his power flowed from himself. But an experience he had with Berkmar raised in his mind serious doubt on the subject. It appears that, In course of their association, Berkmar left Quimby for a time and was engaged to diagnose cases for another mesmerist named John Bovey Dodds. Later, a man of considerable repute and author of a book entitled The Philosophy of Electrical Psychology. Dodds had a wealthy clientele compared with that of Quimby, and when Berkmar came back to him again, as he eventually did, Quimby found that the remedies he had been prescribing while working for Dodds were much too costly for Quimby's patients. The two conferred on the subject. Berkmar agreed to prescribe cheaper remedies, and the patients got well just the same, we are told. As the result of this and other experiences, it gradually began to dawn on Quimby that the healing agent was faith in the drugs and not the drugs themselves. Here he would seem to have arrived at much the same point as had Mary Patterson from her experiments with homeopathy. Their fundamental divergence thence onwards lay in the fact that Quimby sought his solution along the lines of a philosophy, Mary Patterson sought hers along the lines of revealed religion in the broadest sense of that term. But that is, of course, to anticipate the record. When Mary Patterson wrote to him from Romney in the early summer of 1862, Dr. Quimby had a commodious suite in the International Hotel in Portland and was treating as many as 500 patients a year. His remarkable cures were talked of everywhere, and the nearer one got to Portland, the more detailed was the picture. When Mary reached Dr. Vail's sanatorium, she found that Dr. Quimby of Portland and his work were one of the main subjects of conversation. The whole sanatorium seemed to be in a state of vague unrest and expectancy. Several of the patients had actually been to Portland and seen Quimby. One Julius Dresser, afterwards to figure so prominently in Mary Patterson's life and story, returned to the sanatorium from such a visit shortly after Mary got there. He was much improved in health and quite enthusiastic about Quimby's work and methods. Mary was more than ever satisfied that she must get to Portland at all costs. She was, however, entirely without funds of her own, and there was apparently no one upon whom she could call. Abigail would not think of sending her money for such a purpose. She did, however, send her little extra sums from time to time, and these Mary saved carefully, denying herself the small comforts for which the money was intended. She grew worse rather than better, and at last she wrote to Quimby again, almost in despair. She wants to come to him. Apparently she has at last the wherewithal to pay her way, but now the question arises, has she the strength to make the journey? After saying how clearly she now sees the mistake she made in not trying to reach him when she had more strength, she continues by explaining that her stay for 2 or 3 months at this water cure place has been anything but helpful. Her ability to walk several miles has diminished until she can only sit up in bed occasionally, and now doubts whether she has the strength to reach him, or having that, whether any foundation or reserve would be left for him to build on. I would rather die with my friends at Sandbutton. Hence, I shall go to you to live, or them to die very soon. Please answer this yourself." Quimby answered at once with that kindly consideration which seems to have been characteristic of the man, encouraging Mrs. Patterson to come to him, and assuring her she would be able to make the journey. And so, a few weeks later, Mary Patterson set out for Portland, and on October 10, 1862, presented herself at Quimby's office at the International Hotel. She was so weak and exhausted that she had to be assisted up the steps to his room. Quimby came out to see her almost at once, and as she looked up, she would have seen advancing towards her a small, kindly man with broad forehead and white silken hair and beard, one who managed somehow to establish for himself at once an atmosphere of sympathy and understanding. It was just what she had longed for, and when he sat down beside her, as was his custom, and maintained quietly that he would explain her trouble to her, and that that explanation would be the cure, she felt herself roused to a sense of expectancy almost reaching exaltation. Anyway, what followed would suggest some such process, for as he told her that she was held in bondage by the opinions of her family and physicians, and that her animal spirit was reflecting its grief upon her body and calling itself spinal disease, that she could be cured and would be cured, a sense of peace and new strength came over her. And, next moment, she was standing before him, healed, no less. She was quite sure of it. Within a few days, with enthusiasm, she was writing about it to the Portland Courier. 3 weeks since, I quitted my nurse and sick room en route for Portland. The belief of my recovery had died out of the heart of those who were most anxious for it. With this mental and physical depression, I first visited P.P. Quimby, and in less than 1 week from that time, I ascended by a stairway of 182 steps to the dome of the City Hall, and am improving ad infinitum. And so her great hope was fulfilled. She was healed. There could be no question of it in her mind. She must, however, learn the way of it. She had no doubt whatever that the method of Quimby's work was one that could be elucidated and learned by anyone who applied himself to the study. Quimby himself does not seem to have been so sure. He is reported frequently to have declared that he did not know how it was done. But even as early as her letter to the Portland Courier, Mary Patterson seems to have had no doubt at all on the subject. Quimby had rediscovered the healing method of Jesus. She had to go through deep waters, indeed, before she was reluctantly satisfied that this was not so. Meanwhile, she began at once, with the eager devotion of a convinced disciple, to take the things of Quimby and set them up as waymarks along her own spiritual journey. She spent every moment she could in his suite at the International Hotel, talking to him, asking him questions, reading any notes or longer manuscripts he had to give her, and building up her own concept of the new teaching at a rate which must at times have kept the kindly little doctor running breathlessly behind, if indeed he was able to follow her at all. Quimby, however, seems to have appreciated it all immensely. He was, in many ways, a remarkably selfless man. At the time Mary Patterson came to him, his work and teaching were his very life. He cared little or nothing for the money his practice brought him. Many times his letters to patients, a great number of which letters are still preserved, show him returning money that had been sent him on the ground that, for some reason or other, he did not feel that he had earned it. He was, moreover, always eager to learn more of his own doctrine, and he must have regarded with interest, if not assent, Mrs. Patterson's confident interpretation of everything he taught in the light of religious faith. Mary Patterson was probably happier in these few weeks than ever before in her troubled life. At first, she seems to have enjoyed perfect health. No doubt intervened at any point to give her pause, and life must have seemed opening out to her with a promise such as she had never ventured even to outline before. And then, right in the midst of it all, a strange thing happened, one that must have seemed to her, in her overflowing gratitude, yet another instance of the power of her newfound faith. One day, a message was brought to her in her room at the International Hotel that a gentleman was below who desired to speak to her. And when she went down, there stood Daniel, very thin and worn, sadly unkempt and very chastened. He had escaped from the Confederate prison, and after many bitter hardships had found his way first to Sandbutton and then as quickly as he could on to Portland to his wife. In spite of all their strange incompatibility, it must have been a happy reunion. Patterson would be at his best in such circumstances, and the appeal of his chastened self and condition to Mary would have carried all before it. It was all so utterly unexpected. Some months previously, Mary had had a letter from him, not from Libby, but from Salisbury, North Carolina, whither, fortunately for him, he had been removed shortly after his capture. It was dated May 19, 1862, and after telling his wife how McClellan's eternal tardiness had blasted their hope of liberty, he added how they felt now. They were fixed for the war beyond a possibility of earlier release. He went on to dilate on the comfort of his surroundings. North Carolina in May has much to commend it, and Daniel, it is evident from his letter, was settling down to enjoy it all. "The air," he writes, "is clear and balmy, and I am allowed to breathe as much as I please through the window. My bed is just by the window. I believe all will end right, so be of good cheer. God is over all, and does all things well. Give yourself no uneasiness on my account. Mary would have received the letter about the time she was leaving Rumney with Abigail for Sandbutton, and so it must have set her mind at rest about her husband, at least for the moment. Whether Daniel meant to convey to Mary any hint that he might be planning escape by his innocent mention of the fact that his bed was just by the window, it is not possible to say, but as a matter of fact, the position of his bed evidently did help. For some 4 months later, on the night of September 20th, taking advantage of a heavy rainstorm, Daniel and two companions let themselves down from this window by means of a rope improvised from sheets and blankets, and made good their escape into the adjoining woods. There they wandered for several days, fearful of coming out into the open, and subsisting on what they could get by means of night raids on the gardens, orchards, and chicken roosts of such farms as they came to in the clearings. At last, after 2 months of great hardships, during which they were time and again near recapture, they succeeded in reaching the headquarters of General Milroy of West Virginia. There, they were provided with means for their journey to Washington, where Patterson arrived about the first week in November, continuing on almost immediately to Sandbutton and Portland. On November 26, 1862, the New Hampshire Patriot reported the story in full under the heading, Escape of Dr. Patterson. And a few weeks later, Daniel, fully restored to health, and, it may be hoped, to his usual dress, is lecturing on his experiences in the Mechanics Hall, Portland, no doubt to a large and interested audience who had paid 15 cents each for the privilege. By January 12, 1863, the Pattersons are back again in Sandbutton Bridge, and from Mary's first letter to Quimby, which bears this date, it is clear that her remarkable recovery has greatly impressed her family and friends. 5 or 6 of these friends, she tells Quimby, are going to visit him. While Abigail is anxious he should see her son, Albert, and plans shortly even to see him herself. Lying as it does amid a desert of so much suffering, the letter is like a small oasis of joy. I eat, drink, and am merry. Have no laws to fetter my spirit now, though I am quite as much an escaped prisoner as my dear husband was. Her husband, she sighs, yearns to join the army, and she is trying to acquiesce. However, Daniel seems to have suppressed his yearning and to have refrained from doing anything impetuous. After his many sore trials, the comfortable home of the Tiltons, combined at first with the interest of his friends in his experiences, must have made life seem very pleasant to him. After all, there was plenty of time, and in describing, as few could so well, the horrors of a Confederate prison, he was doing something to arouse proper feeling and raise the general morale. Mary is not so sure that all is well. Her next letter, written from Sandbutton, under date of January 21st, 1863, to Quimby, shows that the situation is worrying her. She longs for a place of her own. While her faith is unimpaired, She fears the onset of old troubles. You know, she writes rather plaintively, I am less than 1 year from the 39 of supposed disease, and the habit is yet so strong upon me that I need your occasional aid. Enclosing a remittance for the last treatment or sitting, she requests another. Sometime in February, Abigail made a trip to Portland to see Quimby, taking her son Albert along with her. The boy, never robust, had contracted habits which were causing his family much anxiety. He smoked to excess and drank considerably, and Mary's complete faith in Quimby evidently aroused in Abigail a genuine hope that he might be able to help and even cure her son. She was, moreover, herself suffering from an abdominal rupture, and Mary was equally insistent that that, too, could be healed. And so Abigail went to Portland, full of a hope which rested, however uneasily, on a fundamental skepticism. For Abigail Tilton had none of Mary's faith. A capable woman with a remarkable executive capacity, she never had had a thought, where Mary had had so many, of questioning the established order. Once, many years before, during a revival at Sandbutton, she had felt the change. Mary had written joyfully to her friend Augusta Holmes about it. But it was not long before she had settled easily back into that routine which made of her religion a habit rather than a faith. Mary, however, had unquestionably been healed. She, Abigail, did not understand it and did not much like it, but if it could help her son, she was willing to try it. And so she went. Mary's next letter to Quimby, written on March 10th, tells the further development of the matter. Abigail and her son had been back at Sandbutton just a week, and already the boy is slipping. She begs Quimby, in behalf of his mother and herself, to renew his influence in order to hold him back from his easy besetting sins. His parents are truly grateful and somewhat encouraged at the success thus far. Somewhat encouraged must indeed have seemed to her in sorry contrast with her own unqualified rejoicing when she had returned to Sandbutton some 2 months earlier. I eat, drink, and am merry, have no laws to fetter my spirit now. But Abigail was not Mary, neither was Albert. Where Quimby succeeded easily with the woman full of faith, he failed completely, as subsequent letters show, with the woman full of doubts and her son. For Mary Patterson had full faith in Quimby. She not only fitted him at once at their first meeting into her ideal, but continued to carry him along with her in the months and years to come through her every spiritual experience. It is not without significance in this connection that a few days before she wrote this last letter to Quimby, she had written a letter to a friend in Portland, evidently one of Quimby's patients, which would seem to indicate that she was already attempting to put into readable form her own interpretation of Quimby's teaching. I will try, she writes, to send my philosophy to Mrs. Tilton when she accompanies her son to the International. But Mary herself is beginning to be full of trouble once again. She is suffering somewhat from old habits, pain in the back and stomach, a cold just now, and bilious. So she wrote to Quimby. And then she has been trying to help Albert. And won't the doctor laugh when she tells him that she is suffering from a constant desire to smoke? But adds pleadingly, "Do pray rid me of this feeling." It was part of Quimby's theory at that time that he took his patient's griefs upon himself and then threw them off by his own superior wisdom. Mary evidently feared her wisdom was not strong enough. Then there was always Daniel. He had at last bestirred himself, it is true, had gone to Lynn, then, as now, a busy manufacturing town some 12 miles north of Boston, and resumed his dental practice in partnership with two other dentists. Mary followed him, but whether Daniel succeeded so well that they could afford to go off on a holiday, or, as is more likely, so ill that there was not much else to do, in any event, the following September found them in Saco, Maine. Saco was Daniel's native town. He had a brother still living there, and so, as they had never been there together before, it is possible that the trip was just one of those little romantic contrivances with which Mary often tried to hold the queer, restless man to whom she had married. Saco, on the Saco River, some 15 miles west-southwest of Portland, was at that time a thriving town with the inevitable grist, cotton, and lumber mills climbing up the river, which at this point drops some 40 feet on its way to the sea a few miles away. It was a cultured place, too, with a fine library and an old established academy. The grand stretches of Old Orchard Beach were close by. The proximity of the little town to Portland was no doubt a great attraction in Mary's eyes. From the one letter of hers to Quimby, written from there, that has been preserved, it may reasonably be inferred that she saw him frequently, as may the fact that she sought his help and advice on the perennial problem which Daniel presented. Growing worse instead of better, he gradually drifted from mild, semi-professional flirtations to more serious and more sordid associations. He would go off and leave his wife for days and weeks at a time. Mary evidently had great hopes of reformation from their visit to Saco, and it is possibly due to the failure of these hopes that she is alluding when she writes to Quimby, "But I have conquered my first disappointment." The letter also contains another appeal for help. They are pathetically frequent from now on. "I would like to have you, in your omnipresence, visit me at 8 o'clock this eve, if convenient. But consult your own time. Only come once a day until I am better." The bitterness of hope deferred was evidently still to be her experience.